As kingfishers catch fire, dragonflies draw flame. As tumbled over rim and roundy wells, stones ring. This is the After Dinner Scholar from Wyoming Catholic College, and I'm your host, Dr. Jim Tonkowicz. Gerard Manley Hopkins' sonnet, As Kingfishers Catch Fire, is one of the 26 poems Wyoming Catholic College graduates have memorized over the course of 4 years, and it's the one our seniors as a class recited during their weekend of graduation festivities. The recitation was led by Dr. Pavlos Papadopoulos, who has a great personal love for this challenging poem. Will you begin by reciting Hopkins' poem for us?
As kingfishers catch fire, dragonflies draw flame. As tumbled over rim in roundy wells, stones ring. Like each tucked string tells, each hung bells, bow swung finds tongue to fling out broad its name. Each mortal thing does one thing and the same. Deals out that being, indoors each one dwells, selves, goes itself, myself it speaks and spells, crying, what I do is me, for that I came. I say more, the just man justices, keeps grace, that keeps all his goings graces, acts in God's eye what in God's eye he is, Christ, for Christ plays in 10,000 places. Lovely in limbs and lovely in eyes not his, to the Father through the features of men's faces.
All right, we start with birds and bugs, and then we've got stones ringing, and tell us about the imagery. How does that develop, and what's Hopkins trying to communicate to us?
Yeah, there's a series of comparisons that he makes, moving through a series of particulars. From kingfishers, as kingfishers catch fire, so also dragonflies draw flame, as tumbled over rim and roundy well stones ring, etc. The imagery I always get with kingfishers catching fire and dragonflies drawing flame, of course, kingfishers and dragonflies are both very colorful, but the catching fire, the kingfisher catches fire when it's in motion, and the dragonfly draws flame after it, also when it's in motion. Kingfishers, as the name suggests, are fishing birds. They dive for fish into a body of water. And dragonflies also often, you see them skimming along the surface of a body of water. And so whenever I read this poem, I always imagine, I'm not sure if this is what Hopkins intended, but I always imagine the sunlight striking water that is then drawn by the dragonfly skimming along the surface, or the kingfisher as it plunges into the water and comes back out. It seems like on their own, these colorful, iridescent animals in their feathers and their plumage, or in the dragonfly's wings, could be said to catch fire or draw flame. But I think I always imagine that additional aquatic element as illuminated, perhaps backlit by a setting sun. I can't say all of that's his intention, but something like that. They are in motion, and that motion shows their dynamism. So we begin in the first line, as kingfishers catch fire, so also dragonflies draw flame. Also, we're beginning with these animals in motion, and then as tumbled over rim in roundy wells, stones ring. I take it that this could have two different meanings. I'm imagining a stone tumbling over a well that is roundy, a round well, and then the stones ring. That to me could be aural or visual. It could be aural in the sense of the stones ring as they bounce off the interior of the well and make a ringing noise, or they could ring in the sense of creating rings when they hit the water at the bottom of the well. And I find that ambiguity interesting because the first line, kingfishers catch fire, dragonflies draw flame, is visual. Here we have an image that could be visual or auditory. And then the next image is auditory. Like each tucked string tells, I take it that that's when you pluck the string of a guitar or violin or something. Like each tucked string tells, each hung bells, bow swung, finds tongue to fling out broad its name. That's also auditory. That's a complicated one. I could talk a little bit about what I think's going on with the bell. Shall I do that?
Sure.
So the bell is hung, like each hung bell's bow swung, finds tongue to fling out broad its name. The tongue of the bell, that's a name for the clapper that hangs down in the middle of the bell, so that when you swing the bell, the outside of the bell finds, or the interior of the bell itself finds the tongue. It runs into the tongue because the bell itself is the part that is being swung, and then it's able to fling out broad its name. The bell itself looks like a bow. I'm not sure if this is what Hopkins is going for, but if you draw out a bell and then the clapper or tongue hanging down, it looks like a bow and arrow pointed straight upwards. And so the bow of the bell swinging finds the tongue, and as a result, it flings out broad its name. After that series, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 of five very complex images, both visual and auditory, Hopkins makes what I take to be a general statement or a series of attempts at stating this principle generally. He says, each mortal thing does one thing and the same, deals out that being, indoors each one dwells, selves, that's a verb, selves, goes itself, myself, it speaks and spells, crying, what I do is me, for that I came. Every mortal thing does the self same thing, though it's distinctive to the thing in question. Every mortal thing deals out the being that dwells within itself, that dwells indoors itself. Every mortal thing selves as a verb. You, and I, and the dog, dogs, and the cat, cats, and the kingfisher catches fire in doing this activity. It goes itself, speaks and spells itself, crying, what I do is me. The activity, the distinctive activity of my specific self is what I am. For that I came. I take it to mean that's the reason that I came into being. That's the reason that I exist.
So everything exists for what it does. The dog exists to dog.
Yeah, the horse exists to horse. The stone exists to stone, whatever that is. And what Hopkins gave us in the opening lines is evidence that these are not inert, boring, mundane, although they are mundane of the world, but they're not dull. These are not dull things that the stone does when it is stoning, or that the dog does when it is dogging. The kingfisher catches fire. There's something wondrous and dynamic and illuminating and sort of overflowing in it performing its characteristic activity. That's a very dry way of saying the dragonfly draws flame. The dragonfly is dragonflying. And then there's a break in the poem, and he begins the second half where he says, I say more. And somehow the second half of the poem is something distinct from what a merely mortal thing does. So I think it builds on it.
It's like we're suddenly in a different world with the second part of the poem.
Yeah, perhaps I'm being too Thomistic here, but I wonder if the first part is nature and the second part is grace, which builds on nature, right? So the first part, it's the kingfisher, the dragonfly, the stone, the string, the bell, these mortal things deal out the being that's endured themselves. And then he says, I say more, the just man justices. We are all of a sudden dealing with man, who is mortal but also immortal in terms of our soul. And then he introduces grace explicitly. The just man justices keeps grace. That keeps all his goings graces. By keeping grace, he, the just man, ensures that all of his goings, all of his doings, all of his dealings are graces. Acts in God's eye what in God's eye he is, Christ.
Well, that's confusing.
What does that mean? He, the just man, acts in the eye of God what he truly is in the eye of God, which is Christ. So there's some way in which we're all made in the image of God, and we are all called also to be images of Christ, to act like Christ, and to be Christ-like. And I think what Hopkins is saying here is the just man is the one who actually achieves that. To use Aristotelian terminology, the just man is the one who fully fulfills his potential. He really actualizes his potential as man, which means as made in the image and likeness of God, which means he actually becomes Christ, by justicing, by keeping grace. And so Hopkins says, he acts in God's eye what in God's eye he is, Christ. For Christ plays in 10,000 places. And these last few lines are quite complex as well. For Christ plays in 10,000 places, lovely in limbs and lovely in eyes, not his, to the Father through the features of men's faces. I take it that that means Christ plays to the Father in 10,000 places through the features of men's faces. So Christ is somehow performing through men's faces. Christ is somehow living through all just men or all men and women in those moments when we actually manage to be Christ-like for a moment or for a few moments. What's really happening there, Hopkins is saying, is Christ is somehow present in that person and playing before the Father. He's sort of performing something for the Father. He is lovely in limbs and lovely in eyes, not his. So we, these 10,000 places, 10,000 people, the men's faces, we are all lovely in limbs and lovely in eyes, although we are not Christ. We are still beloved by the Father. And when we manage to actually be, or through grace, through keeping grace, when we manage to actually justice, when we manage to be the just man justicing, we are playing before Christ, or we're playing before the Father, and we are becoming Christ for a moment.
Is he referring back to the text about the sheep and the goats in Matthew's gospel, mm-hmm. do you think? Where Christ says, when you didn't do this to the least of these, you didn't do it to me. And that on the one hand, and on the other hand, Paul saying, for me to live is Christ.
Mm-hmm. He very well may be, yes. Yeah, that certainly sounds right to me. Yeah.
Pastor Eugene Peterson, in his book, Christ Plays in 10,000 Places, wrote that this sonnet, quote, provides an arresting and accurate statement on the end of human life well lived. Does that sum up the poem?
Yeah, Hopkins introduces us through the animal and inanimate object imagery in the first stanza. He introduces us to this idea, which we all know in some way, which is that there's something, some distinctive activity that every being has that's proper to itself. And that when you see, for example, a horse galloping through a field, you know that you're really seeing the horse in a fuller sense at that moment than when the horse is dozing in the middle of the day or penned up in a stall or something like that. When the horse is able to actually fulfill its potential as a horse, you're able to see what the horse is. That's what you would want to sort of capture in a short video if you wanted to introduce someone to a horse. This is what a horse is. See, here's what it does. This is the kind of thing it is. There's something like that for man as well. And the way that Hopkins puts it here is both in a kind of natural and supernatural way. The just man justices. It's interesting the way he introduces that second part of the poem. He says, I say more, the just man justices. We may be simply in the realm of nature there. Aristotle talks about justice without reference to God. And yet Hopkins immediately says, keeps grace. And so he's showing that not only is natural justice or the natural virtues, those aren't the fullness of our end as human beings. They might prepare us for or lead us into or participate in, point us towards the supernatural fullness of our end, which is keeping grace and becoming godlike, becoming Christlike, and therefore playing before the Father.
I also just quickly counted lines.
Mm-hmm.
And the center of the poem is, selves go itself, goes itself. Myself it speaks and spells, crying, what I do is me, mm-hmm. for that I came.
Mm-hmm.
So you have six lines mm-hmm. talking about nature and kingfishers and mm-hmm. and bows, you know, bells and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And then six lines talking about human beings
mm-hmm.
In the image of Christ.
Mm-hmm.
Is he saying, this is what I do is me, this for this I came,
mm-hmm.
to be Christ playing in 10,000 places.
Mm-hmm. And that's what's distinctive to man, and right, he draws us from these natural, merely mortal things to man and to God. But it's worth dwelling on the way in which those this applies, those central lines that you've identified apply to the kingfisher and the dragonfly and the stone as well. They go themselves, myself, it speaks in spells, crying, what I do is me, for that I came. The stone came into being for a reason as well, and that somehow is part of God's plan. I'm tempted again to think of Thomas Aquinas in the Summa when he speaks in what the section called the Treatise on Law. He speaks about the eternal law, which is the law governing all things. It's not divine law in the sense of scripture that's revealed to man specifically, but it is the law, the will of God as manifest in the universe. And whenever I teach that text, I think a great example of this is gravity, right? The stone by falling, or any massive body being attracted to other massive bodies, just by virtue of existing in a gravitational field, that is a way in which a body with mass is obeying the will of God, right? So we think of obedience to God, and we primarily think of animals with reason and a will, right? Like men and angels and so on. And of course, we have a more complex and maybe perfect way of obeying God. And of course, we have understanding and will, but everything in the universe is subject to God, and the way in which merely massive objects are subject to God is by obeying the law of gravity. What Hopkins does with the example of the stone, is he captures that obedience to the law of gravity, but he also shows that there's something terrific and radiant going on. As tumbled over rim and roundy well, stones ring. There's something wondrous even in these mundane things, and the brilliant irrational animals like the kingfisher and the dragonfly, the way in which they perform their distinctive activity and thereby do what they came into being to do, they are giving glory to God, whether it's by diving for the fish or by creating ripples at the bottom of a well.
What do our students think of this poem? I think it's significant that our seniors recited this as a class.
They did. So what happened was this poem is not in our curriculum. My first semester here, I was teaching the sophomores who just graduated as seniors, and we flew through the three poems assigned for the semester in sophomore humanities, and they were so caught up in the poetry, they asked me for another poem. And I had taught them and learned in order to teach them another poem by Hopkins, Pied Beauty, which is assigned for that semester. And that had reminded me of this other poem, Kingfishers, that I had come across years ago and had never thought deeply about. And so I had been working on memorizing it myself that semester. And when they asked me for a new poem, I said, "Okay, I'll give me a day, and then I'll memorize this poem, and then we can work on it together." They were really struck by it and fell in love with it, and I fell in love with it at the same time. And I've introduced it to a few succeeding classes ever since. The most recently, this past fall, the sophomores, when we learned Kingfishers, they found all kinds of connections to their theology. They were doing the theology of the Trinity during the same semester. They were really struck by this idea that we become Christ-like, or Christ is somehow present in us and playing through us to the Father. I also think I keep making these connections to Aristotle and to Thomas Aquinas. I think that those four lines at the end of the first part of the poem, "Each mortal thing does one thing in the same," deals out that being indoors each one dwells, selves goes itself, myself it speaks in spells, crying, "What I do is me, for that I came." I think that's a wonderful poetic rendition of this Aristotelian idea, or Thomistic idea, which is not, it's not to say that Hopkins was reading Aristotle and Thomas and then said, "Let me write a poem about this," but they're all looking at reality and noticing the same thing, which is that creatures have purposes. They are made to do something, and made to do something well. And you see the excellent specimen of a thing, a kingfisher or a dragonfly, when it is performing that specific activity well. And the word that Aristotle uses for this in Greek is energeia, or entelecheia, right? So it's energeia, having the end in itself, the ergon, or excuse me, having the work or function within itself, or entelecheia, having the end, the telos, the final end in itself, in a mode of activity, of doing something. That's what we translate as actuality or activity when we go through the Latinate translation of Thomas Aquinas. And that's really what Hopkins is capturing here, which is that the full act, the full actuality, the full activity of a thing doing the thing that's proper to itself is it displaying its end, the purpose for which it exists, showing a glimpse of its purpose as God has given it a purpose to pursue.
And that's regardless of whether it's a kingfisher or a king.
Or a king.
or any other human
being. A peasant
being.
Or a baby or anything. This other poem, which our students learn, Pied Beauty, I think is helpful to think about here. Hopkins writes, "Glory be to God for dappled things, for skies of couple color, as a brinded cow." He says, "Glory be to God for this really brilliant thing, the skies of couple color, brilliant, bright, two-tone sky, like a cow." Right? He brings the high and the low together and says that all of this is all of this is glorifying God. Later in that same poem, he says, "With swift, slow, sweet, sour, a dazzle dim, he fathers forth whose beauty is past change, praise him." In other words, with this high and low register, swift and slow, sweet and sour, a dazzle and dim, with all of those, both brilliant and apparently dull, God fathers forth whose beauty is past change. His transcendent, unchanging beauty is somehow present in all of these changing, dappled things, even the most dull or apparently unremarkable, somehow contain and point us towards the glory of God.
And Christ playing in 10,000 places.
Mm-hmm.
Eugene Peterson went on to write, quote, "We sense that life is more than what we are in touch with this moment, but not different from it, not unrelated to it. We get glimpses of wholeness and vitality that exceed what we can muster out of our own resources. We get hits of congruence between who and what we are in the world around us, rocks and trees, meadows and mountains, birds and fish, kingfishers and dragonflies, obscure and fleeting but convincing confirmations that we are all in this together, that we are all kin to all that is and has been and will be. We have this feeling in our bones that we are involved in an enterprise that is more than the sum of the parts that we can account for by looking around us and making an inventory of the details of our bodies, our families, our thoughts and feelings, the weather and the news, our job and leisure activities. We have this feeling that we will never quite make it out, never be able to explain or diagram it, that we will always be living a mystery, but a good mystery." Close quote. It's a mystery in which Christ plays in 10,000 places. For Wyoming Catholic College, this is Dr. Jim Tonkowicz.